Hey everyone, welcome back to the Deep Dive. You know why you're here, right? To get right down to the nitty-gritty of the stuff that matters, without all the fluff.
Absolutely. We're all about cutting through the noise.
Exactly. And today we're going deep, really deep, into a legal case that might seem like a blast from the past, but trust me, it's still shaping the way banks do business and how your rights as a consumer are protected.
You got it. We're talking Purdue v. Crocker National Bank, a California Supreme Court case all the way back in 1985.
Yeah, 1985. Now, I know what you might be thinking, that's ancient history, right? But hold on, because the core issues at play in Purdue, they're more relevant now than ever, especially when you think about all the debates swirling around stuff like overdraft fees and how much power banks really have.
Couldn't agree more. This case, it's like a cornerstone for understanding the whole tug of war between big financial institutions and everyday folks like us.
It's about fairness, right? Like, can banks just make up their own rules when it comes to fees, or does the state have a duty to step in and say, hold on, that's just not right?
Exactly. And that's what's so fascinating about Purdue. It really grapples with those fundamental questions. And even though the world of banking has changed a ton since 1985, with online banking and all these newfangled financial tech companies popping up, the core principles of fairness and accountability, they're still at the heart of it all.
Totally. So let's rewind back to 1985. Set the scene for us. What was the deal with this Purdue case? Who was Paul Purdue, and what went down with Crocker National Bank?
Well, the story starts with something I bet most of us have experienced at some point. Those pesky non-sufficient funds fees, the dreaded NSF fees. You know, when you write a check, but oops, not enough money in the account to cover it.
Yeah, we've all been there. So what happened?
So Paul Purdue, he was representing a whole group of customers, filed a lawsuit against Crocker National Bank. At the time, Crocker was charging $6 every time a check bounced because of insufficient funds. $6?
$6 back then, that's what? It's not nothing, but what was the real issue? Why did that spark a whole lawsuit?
It was all about the difference between that $6 fee and what the bank was actually shelling out to process these bounced checks. Purdue claimed it was only costing Crocker about 30 cents per check.
Wait, seriously? So like a 2,000% markup?
You got it. That's a huge difference. Imagine going to the store and buying, I don't know, a loaf of bread for $6 when it only costs the store a few pennies to stock it. That's the kind of disparity we're talking about here, and it's what got people fired up about the fairness of these bank fees.
Yeah, I can see why folks would be upset about that. A $6 fee when it only costs them 30 cents, that's a lot of profit for the bank.
So how did Crocker try to justify these fees? What was their legal argument? Well, they pointed to the signature card that everyone signs when they open a bank account. You know, those standard agreements with all the fine print. Buried in there is usually a clause that says something like, the account holder agrees to be bound by the bank's rules, regulations, practices, and charges. But here's the kicker. The signature card didn't actually spell out how much these fees would be.
Interesting. So basically they were saying, you agree to our fees even though we didn't tell you what they were.
Pretty much. And that brings us to a super important legal concept, especially in cases like this, the contract of adhesion. It's basically a take it or leave it kind of contract where one party, in this case the bank, has way more power than the other party, the individual customer.
Right, because it's not like you can walk into a bank and start negotiating their fee schedule. You pretty much have to accept their terms if you want to open an account. So Purdue and his legal team, they went to court, right? What were their main arguments against Crocker?
They had a few legal arrows in their quiver. One of their biggest arguments was that this $6 NSF fee was unconscionable. Now, that's a legal term that basically means something is so ridiculously unfair or oppressive that it just shocks the conscience.
Unconscionable. I like that word. So they were saying these fees were so out of whack that it just wasn't right.
Exactly. And they also argued, building on what we talked about earlier, that this signature card was a classic example of a contract of adhesion and that these fees were unfair competition, basically, hurting consumers and stifling competition in the market. They even claimed the fees were an unlawful penalty.
Wow, they really threw the book at Crocker.
Yeah.
But what happened initially? Did the court agree with them?
Not at first. The trial court actually dismissed the whole case.
Really? That's surprising. So even with this huge fee markup and this take it or leave it contract, the lower court wasn't buying it.
Nope. But Purdue and his team, they weren't giving up. They appealed the decision and the case eventually made its way to the California Supreme Court.
Ah, okay. So this is where things get interesting. This is where the legal precedent is set. what happened when it reached the Supreme Court?
Right. This is where it gets juicy. The California Supreme Court, they took a good hard look at this case and decided that it raised some really important big picture questions about how banks and their customers should interact.
I bet. So what were the specific legal issues that the Supreme Court decided to focus on?
Okay, so they zeroed in on five main legal issues. First, they wanted to figure out whether that signature card actually created a legit contract that gave the bank the power to charge fees. And if it did that power come with a built-in responsibility, a duty of good faith, when setting those fees?
I see. So even if the signature card was a valid contract, the bank couldn't just go wild with the fees, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that leads us to the second big issue, the potential unconscionability of those fees. The court looked at that massive gap between the $6 fee and the 30-cent cost and basically said, this definitely smells fishy. We need to take a closer look here. We didn't outright rule that it was unconscionable at that point, but they said it raised a serious enough question that it needed a full investigation, a trial, to dig into the facts.
Okay, so that's a pretty significant win for consumers, isn't it? The court was willing to question whether the fee itself was fair, not just whether the bank had the right to charge a fee in the first place.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It was a big deal. Then the third issue was whether this NSF fee was actually a sneaky way of imposing an unlawful penalty. The fourth issue was whether the bank was engaging in unfair competition by charging these fees. And the fifth issue, and this one is huge, was whether California, as a state, could even regulate these fees, or if federal banking laws trumped everything.
Gotcha. So they tackled the contracts, the fairness of the fee, the penalty question, the competition angle, and then this whole federal versus state power dynamic. Let's break those down one by one. What did the court say about that signature card as a contract?
Okay, so on the contract front, the Supreme Court basically agreed with Crocker. They said, yep, that signature card does create a contractual relationship, and it does give the bank the general authority to impose fees. However, and this is big however, they also said that this authority wasn't unlimited. It came with a built-in duty of good faith and fair dealing.
So even though you sign that agreement, the bank can't just go crazy and charge whatever they want, right? They have to act fairly.
Precisely. And that takes us to the second biggie, unconscionability. This is where Purdue really made its mark. The court, remember, they looked at that huge difference between the $6 fee and the 30-cent cost and said, hold up, this could be seriously unfair. They didn't say for sure it was unconscionable yet, but they said it raised enough red flags that it needed to go back to a lower court for a full trial.
I see. They wanted more information to see if that fee was truly justified. So what about that third issue? Was the fee an illegal penalty?
Actually, the court sided with Crocker on this one. They said that bouncing a check isn't technically a breach of your contract with the bank.
Really? How so?
They saw it more like you're asking the bank for a favor, like, hey, can you cover this check even though I don't have enough money? Or can you return this check unpaid?
So it's not you breaking the contract. It's you asking for an extra service, and the bank can charge for that service.
That's the gist of it. And because it's not considered a breach of contract, they said the fee couldn't be considered a penalty in the legal sense.
Okay, interesting distinction. So maybe not a penalty, but still potentially unconscionable if it's way too high. What about that fourth issue, the unfair competition claim?
Yeah, the court wasn't totally sold on that one. They felt like Purdue's initial complaint didn't give enough specific details about how Crocker's fees were supposedly hurting competition. They said if Purdue wanted to pursue that claim, he needed to beef it up, add more meat to the bones.
So it was a bit too vague, not enough concrete evidence to support it. Okay, and now for the big one, federal preemption. Can California, as a state, even regulate these fees? Or does federal law have the final say?
This is where Purdue really sent shockwaves through the banking world. Crocker, they argued that federal banking laws, specifically the National Bank Act, completely blocked California from having any say in how they set their fees. Their argument was that they were a national bank, they operated under a federal charter, so federal law was the only law that mattered.
That makes sense in a way, a federal charter, a federal law, right. But what did the California Supreme Court say about that?
They said, nope, not so fast. They basically told Crocker, listen, unless there's a federal law that specifically says states can't regulate this particular aspect of banking, or if California's law would actually prevent you from doing your job as a national bank, then California's law still stands, especially when it comes to protecting consumers.
That's a big statement. So the state still has power unless there's a very clear and specific reason why federal law should step in.
Exactly. And the court went even further. They said, the burden of proof is on the bank, to show why the state law shouldn't apply. They can't just say, we have a federal charter, so we do what we want.
I see. The bank can't just wave the federal charter flag and expect to be exempt from all state laws. So this ruling, it really affirmed the power of states to keep an eye on banks and make sure they're playing fair, right?
Absolutely. It was a major victory for states' rights and for consumer protection. It basically said that states have a responsibility to look out for their citizens, even when it comes to big national banks.
So Purdue was a big deal for a lot of reasons. It forced banks to justify their fees, it gave states more power to regulate, and it really put the spotlight on this whole concept of unconscionability in contracts. Let's talk a bit more about that. For our listeners who might be future lawyers, can we break down what unconscionability really means in a legal sense? What factors does a court consider?
Sure, let's unpack that. Unconscionability, it's basically a legal doctrine that says, hey, some contract terms are so unfair, so one-sided, that they just can't stand. And there are two main parts to it, procedural unconscionability and substantive unconscionability.
Okay, two sides to the same coin. What's procedural unconscionability all about?
Procedural unconscionability, it's all about how the contract was formed, the process. Were the terms buried in a bunch of fine print that nobody could possibly read? Was there such a huge power imbalance between the parties that one side had no chance to negotiate, making the whole thing feel coercive or sneaky?
So, like in Purdue, where that fee authorization was hidden in the fine print of a standard contract that everyone had to sign, that could be seen as procedurally unconscionable, right?
Yep, that's a classic example. And then you have substantive unconscionability, which focuses on the actual terms of the contract itself. Are the terms so ridiculously one-sided, so harsh, that they just scream unfairness?
So, like, in Purdue, that 2,000% markup on the NSF fee, that could be seen as substantively unconscionable.
You got it. The court was basically saying that kind of massive, seemingly unjustified price difference raises a huge red flag, and we need to dig deeper to see if there's any legitimate reason for it.
It's like the contract itself, the way it was formed, and the actual terms of the contract, they both have to pass the fairness test.
That's it in a nutshell. And don't forget about the duty of good faith, which is like this underlying principle that runs through all contracts.
Right. You mentioned that earlier. Remind us how good faith plays into all of this.
Sure. The duty of good faith basically means that in any contract, the parties are expected to act honestly and reasonably with each other. They can't use the contract to screw each other over or pull any shady moves.
So even if the contract technically allows something, if one party is using it to be a jerk, that could be a breach of good faith.
You got it. And in Purdue, the court was hinting that maybe, just maybe, setting crazy high fees without a good reason could violate this duty of good faith.
That makes sense. It's not just about what the contract says. It's about the spirit of fairness and honesty that should be at the heart of any agreement. Now, circling back to that federal preemption issue one last time, because it's so important, why exactly did the court decide in favor of the state in Purdue? What was their legal reasoning?
Okay, so the court relied on this well-established legal principle called the presumption against preemption. Basically, it means that courts start with the assumption that federal law doesn't automatically wipe out state law. States have the power to make their own laws, especially in areas that have traditionally been under their control, like consumer protection.
So, unless there's a super clear federal law that says, states, hands off, this is our territory, the states can generally regulate, right?
That's the idea.
Yeah.
And the court looked at the National Bank Act, which is the big federal law that governs national banks, and they said, look, this law gives banks some powers, but it doesn't say that states can't do anything related to bank fees. It's not like Congress wrote a law that said only the federal government can regulate bank fees and states, you're out of the picture.
So because there wasn't a specific federal law that blocked states from regulating, California was in the clear.
Exactly. And remember, the court put the burden on Crocker to prove that California's law was a no-go. Crocker couldn't just say, we're a national bank, end of story. They had to show why California's law would actually mess up their ability to operate as a national bank.
So states have the power to regulate banks unless there's a really good reason why they shouldn't. That's a pretty big win for consumer protection, wouldn't you say?
Oh, for sure. It gives states more tools to make sure banks are playing by the rules and treating their customers fairly. So to sum it all up, Purdue was a landmark case because it really clarified the boundaries between federal and state power in banking regulation. And it reinforced this crucial idea that banks, even big national banks, aren't above the law and that they have to act fairly and reasonably when setting their fees.
Right. And even though the court didn't say for sure whether those $6 NSF fees were unconscionable, just by sending the case back for a trial, they put banks on notice that those kinds of markups were going to be scrutinized, and they'd better have a good explanation ready.
Absolutely. And that's why Purdue is still so relevant today. Think about all the debates we're having now about overdraft fees, ATM fees, all sorts of bank charges.
Mm-hmm.
Purdue laid the groundwork for challenging those fees, for saying, hey, banks, you need to justify these fees. You can't just charge whatever you want.
It's like Purdue planted a seed, and it's grown into this whole movement for fairness and transparency in banking.
I like that analogy. It's like Purdue said, we need sunlight on these fees. We need to understand how they're calculated, and we need to make sure they're reasonable.
And that brings us to a final thought for our listeners, especially those of you who might be future legal eagles. We've talked a lot about traditional banking, but the world of finance is changing rapidly, right? We have all these online banks, these fintech companies, these new payment platforms popping up all over the place.
It's a whole new frontier out there.
Exactly. So the question is, how do these principles of fairness, transparency, and accountability that we've been talking about, how do they apply to this new digital landscape? How do we make sure that the spirit of Purdue extends beyond brick and mortar banks to this whole new world of online finance? It's something to think about, something to keep an eye on as you navigate your careers in law.
Couldn't have said it better myself. It's a challenge, but it's also an opportunity to shape the future of financial regulation and make sure that it serves everyone fairly.
Well said. And that's a wrap for this deep dive into Purdue v. Crocker National Bank. As always, thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.
See you then.